I am particularly happy to have the honor of introducing Dr. Ernest Wolff. I'd like to take just a moment to speak of his great academic background, but that's not the most important thing to me about Dr. Wolff. Dr. Wolff was widely trained. He went to the University of Bonn, University of Berlin, University of Munster, the Sorbonne in Paris, University of California in Los Angeles, and USC. You can see he's had a very wide background in many, many places. Dr. Wolff came to San Diego State, I think, just about the same year that I did. And it was my pleasure to have great respect and great appreciation for his contribution to the university in all those years. He was the one who established a special clinic, a language clinic, which he was in charge of for a number of years. He has written many, many articles, and he's just completed a book, which is now in the hands of the publisher. But it isn't for this that I remember most Dr. Wolff. He took many humanities tours to Europe, taking students and showing them the art treasures, the cathedrals, and so forth. And it was my great pleasure in 1956 to be his assistant. And here is where I saw the sterling qualities emerge. If I may tell you just one incident. We had a very naughty 18-year-old boy on this tour. He was spoiled. He was a brat. And he looked at his first trip to Europe as a chance to do all the things that his parents had not allowed him to do. So the first thing he did when we arrived in Paris was to buy a quantity of liquor, which he consumed on the bus as we rode into town. We had talked to him about the dangers of the Seine, that it was really a kind of a sewer, and that nobody went swimming there. So by this point, he was quite inebriated, and he thought swimming there was a very fine idea. He took with him three of our other tour members. I don't know whether Dr. Wolff is cringing at the fact that I'm telling these gory details, which we kept secret for some time. So about this time, he jumped in sans clothing and swam around. He began to sober up a bit. But each time when he would try to emerge from the Seine, a crowd would gather. And with a kind of a moral attitude of an American, he didn't feel he should get out naked. So he would go to another place. He finally had to come out in a very dark place under one of those arches, and in so doing, cut himself very badly. The arch of his foot was quite badly cut. So I remember Dr. Wolff calling me at something like 1 in the morning and saying, we have to go to the hospital and see what to do about this. In the meantime, this naughty boy had been transported by the police to an emergency hospital near the Seine, and he saw a couple of flies buzzing around and decided that this was not a clean and hygienic place. So by the time he had finished yelling, American hospital, a number of times to the woman doctor who was in charge, she was sitting in stony-faced silence as Dr. Wolff walked in, and I walked behind. Well, I have to say this for the boy. She, at this point, was not about to give him an anesthetic. And, and so he took another swig from his bottle, and in heroic fashion, let her sew him up. He then was a good boy in a cast for a while. Through all this, Dr. Wolff was patient and kind and understanding, and I admired him so much. And so it's this part of Dr. Wolff, the personal quality, that I'm thinking of tonight. So as we introduce him, he will speak, as you noted, on your announcements. On the Amagon, I didn't say that right. Amagon. Well, you say it for me. Collection, about which we've heard so much. So, Dr. Wolff, it is yours.
ladies and gentlemen, members of the Friends of the Library. Thank you, Sue, for your kind and undeserved words, undeserved on my part. There are no more secrets, of course. The lid is off, it seems. I had forgotten this incident, but I know without the assistance of Sue, I couldn't have pulled through. When Sue, your chairperson for the evening, approached me to be the speaker for tonight, I asked what I should speak on, and she said, "You can speak on any topic you want, anything under the sun." But I didn't have to rack my brains, look very far for the topic to choose. The choice was very simple, natural, and logic. It was the Amelung Collection, because the Amelung Collection is the most important event in the year that has passed since your organization and mine has gathered the last time. It is also the most important and singular event, perhaps, in the whole history of this library in which we sit. Why is that? Well, 11,000 books have been added to the holdings of this library. With one stroke of a pen, of a signature under a check, our holdings were increased by this much. I would say that in the area of humanities, and of which most of the books in the Amelung Collection fall, this is the equivalent, at least, of an atom smasher for the physics department, or a high-power telescope for the astronomy department, or a football hero hired away from a national league for our physical education department. There can be no doubt in anybody's mind that this collection, quantitatively and qualitatively, means a giant step up and forward for the library and for our institution. Dr. Kenny and his associates, particularly Dr. Szabo, his librarian for special collections, should be highly commended for their foresight and perseverance in making possible this purchase. In addition, the Friends of the Library, under the administration of Mrs. Mary Wright, should also be commended and congratulated for having contributed such a substantial share to the purchase price of the collection. I would say that this acquisition in order of magnitude is for the library and for the university perhaps comparable in the history of this country to the Louisiana Purchase or the Purchase of Alaska. It is a great bargain, because on the average, you and we paid $3, a little bit more than $3 for each of the books. And you already heard that there is one that is at least worth $15,000. We'll hear more about it later. So Dr. Kenny not only is a great finder of bargains, he is also a great bargainer, because somebody had estimated the collection at $150,000, and he was able to purchase it at this bargain basement price. Now, it is a miracle that we got it at all. A miracle that it wasn't snapped up by other institutions. The wolves howling in the background in Los Angeles, UCLA, Irvine, UCSD, closer to our own home ground, or UC, or other institutions in the state and university college system, state university and college system. Like Los Angeles State University, or Long Beach, or Fullerton. Well, you know that the Alaska purchase was called Seward's Folly. I trust nobody has called yet and ever will call this purchase Lou Kenny's Folly, because it is the opposite of a folly. It's the sign of high sanity and intelligence to have secured this exceptional collection for our university and institution. Like with as it is with the territorial purchases I have mentioned in connection with it, the full benefit of this marvelous addition will probably accrue only to future generations of students at this institution. There is material for dozens and dozens of master theses and doctor theses in this collection. It has to be mined like a gold mine, and I hope it will be. There is, though, one limiting factor, and that is the fact that about 90% of the books in this collection are written in an exotic and difficult language, which is hardly known anymore in this country, German. There are also books in other languages, of course, in the remaining 10%. I just guess at these numbers. I have no reliable statistics, but of course there are a great number of books in English. And then there are books in French, in Latin, in Dutch, and if my eyesight hasn't deceived me, there are some in Japanese or Chinese. But there is some hope that the foreign language study in this country, which is now at a very low point, may pick up again. President Carter has made some movements towards furthering study of foreign languages and civilizations, and maybe there will be trained enough German reading students in the future to take full advantage of this collection. Now, this sifting, sorting, and cataloging of this purchase is a major undertaking in itself, as you can imagine. A team of five German-speaking student assistants has been at work since March, when the collection was purchased, toiling away in the bowels of this library. I can't say day and night, because night work is not allowed, but they work full-time mostly. They have cataloged 10,000 of the 11,000 items already. Cataloged according to title, but the job is far from done, because the Library of Congress numbers have still to be added, and the author cards to be made out. So there is a lot of work still to be done on it. Now, there is an inevitable comparison to be made of this collection with a previous purchase, a previous collection, the Zinner collection, which some of you may remember. It was purchased 10 years ago exactly, and was the first of the great Lou Kenny purchases. It is a very different from the current collection. It is, first of all, smaller, 5,000 items, just 5,000 items. That's nothing anymore. That was just a warm-up for Dr. Kenny, as you can see. And then it is a very specialized collection on medieval and Renaissance astronomy. The Amelin collection is, as you know, now practically more than double the size, though size alone, of course, numbers will not tell the whole story. But second, it is a non-specialized, encyclopedic collection. Books on practically everything under the sun and the moon, not specialized in any respect. Mr. Amelin, about whom we'll hear a lot more later, was a real bibliophile. He collected everything of value of which he came across, of value to him, of course, first. And like a book collector is like a coin or stamp collector, of course. He first went for the old books, the rare books, unique books, items especially good or elaborate in bindings or in presentation. We have therefore parchment and bindings, leather bindings, tooled and untooled, pig skin and ornamental bindings with gold stamping, with gilt foredges, all kinds of curlicues. We have books with jeweled clasps, and we have books particularly with sumptuous illustrations, black and white and color, etchings, rare and special and limited editions, all the paraphernalia and the goodies a book collector goes after. But not only old books and rare books, but books of current interest, current, say, 19th, 20th century interest. Mr. Amelin obviously did not limit himself to the pure collector's item. He kept up with things, and there are quite a number of very interesting recent and half-recent books there. I'm not a book collector. I own many books, too many, my wife says, feels. Of course, she practically has to move out soon to make room for them. But I use them as tools in my profession of teaching and research. I'm therefore usually more interested in the contents than in the appearance of books. But as a book user, you cannot escape becoming a book lover. And therefore, I do also appreciate the aesthetic attractions and enjoy them. And I must say, when I move among these books and along the shelves in which they are now still housed, I'm dazzled. I'm awed, overawed by the wealth and the abundance of what we purchased. Going through there, you go through a book lover's paradise, really. I feel like, and others I'm sure too, feel like a child in a candy or toy store, or like Aladdin in his cave. It is incredible what treasures are accumulated on these shelves. I have one more special personal reason for feeling particularly grateful for this collection. Many books in the Amelin collection are books which are very familiar to me because I grew up with them in Germany during my school and university and college days. Mr. Amelin is 20 years my senior only, so that is not such a big difference. And he obviously must have studied from many of the same books from which I studied and read and followed through on the same books. One cannot escape when one lives as an intellectual and awake person in Germany. So when I go through these books and through the shelves, I find many books nodding like acquaintances to me. And it is a kind of nostalgia trip also. Well, so much for a personal note. Now, though no single major focus is apparent in the Amelin collection as it is in the Zinner collection, it is possible to establish major areas of interest from the number of items of the same or similar kind represented on one topic. And I'm going to enumerate some of the areas. I cannot hardly ever mention titles because we would be here for several weeks if I wanted to. But I will do something later to make the generalities of which I will have to speak more concrete. First, there are Bibles and related religious literature, prayer books and hymn books. There are four magnificent Bibles in German from 1536, 1614, 1686, and 1740. Beautifully illustrated, most of them, with original woodcuts and engravings, often colored. There is then, of course, the antiphonal, which you have already heard mentioned, which is a religious liturgical book. Then there is a second major area, is history. General history, German history, European history, with many sub-areas and related disciplines. There's ancient history, Josephus and Livy. There are chronicles. There are political books on political history, the works of Frederick the Great. And books on Bismarck, of which you'll see some more later. There is military history on the First and Second World War. There's naval history, ecclesiastical history, heraldry, genealogy, costumes and uniforms. And then there is literature as a third area. All kinds of histories of German literature and other literatures, original works, old and modern, up to the 20th century. A large area represented are German classics, Lessing, Goethe, Schiller. Goethe in two editions of 30 volumes, 19 volumes. It is incredible. It goes on and on. There is a Faust in several editions. There are works of Shakespeare in German with the famous Schlegeltyg translation. Another area is art and art history. European, African, Asian. Of course, these art books are magnificently illustrated, oversized, often hand-colored plates. It is a riot. Then there is geography and travel. And among these, particularly interesting to us, books on America, the Americas and the United States, books on California. And there is one area which has never been named in any of the bulletins of the library about the collection. Erotica. Now, we do not have to make apologies for Mr. Amelin, nor for ourselves in these days of sexual liberation. Erotic art and literature are today respectable research topics in academic and scientific disciplines. There are in the collection histories of erotic literature and art, volumes about erotic and sexual customs and mores in history in various societies, mostly under the German term of Sittengeschichten, which is not sins, but customs. There is, for instance, a four-volume illustrated encyclopedia of erotic literature, art, and sexual customs and practices through the ages and throughout the world. I do not know whether Dr. Kenny intends to make a special collection of these, but in the past...
I didn't know you were there, that's why I didn't.
Well, you know now. In the past, such books were condemned to an enfer, to the hell, and were not accessible. But I think they are will be quite useful. Then there are children's books, charming, the illustrated Victorian, German Victorian kind of fairy tales collections, children's stories, 19th century Victorian, I said that, and also bound volumes of children's periodicals, which we used to enjoy in Germany, for boys and for girls separate and for both sexes together. Now this is just too vast a collection to make an overview of. So the best you can do, of course, is to look at the books. You have already done so downstairs. You have even handled some of them, because you will not have time and opportunity to browse through them. So since this is not possible, I turn to the true and tested teacher's standby to substitute for the real thing, slides. So we will now be able to look at some of the slides, and under the very gracious assistance of Dr. Senner, who volunteered this kind of help of life and voice support system, we will be able to see them. Now, of course, I'm only able to pick a few raisins out of the vast and rich cake of the collection. There will be about 60 slides from 36 books, chosen more or less at random for illustrating certain aspects and facets of the collection, and all will be from the special collection representing the biggest raisins of the cake, of course. Now, Dick, can we turn off? Yeah. On. Pardon? Something wrong?
Getting close.
Oh. Oh. That's what I fear. Well, not here.
Maybe not.
Did you turn on the air conditioning? Now here is the most expensive item and one of the most beautiful items in the collection. This is a manuscript of a Persian, of the Persian poet Hafiz, the divan, or the odes of Hafiz, and it is hand written with seven miniatures written in the 18th century, probably. And the colors in the miniatures are ground up precious stones and real gold. You have heard its value appraised at around $15,000. Each of the miniatures, here's the title, and here is an example of a miniature, is worth about $2,500. So that one book covers practically a third or more or a half of the purchase price of the whole collection. Hafiz, the poet, is together perhaps with Omar Khayyam, the best known Persian poet. He lived in the 14th century, and he's so well known. He's a national poet of Persia that his tomb at Shiraz is a shrine for pilgrims. And the content the odes tell of joys of wine and women, flowers and nightingales, and bemoan the instability of all things human, like Omar Khayyam. This is let's This characterization is a quotation. I have not read the book. I cannot read Persian, but there are translations, of course. Now, the next book you also have seen exhibited on the table. This is first a close-up of the miniature. You have seen on the table downstairs. This is perhaps the heaviest book. It weighs about between 40 and 50 pounds. We couldn't have it brought over to the audiovisual department for photographing because it was so heavy. So we had to photograph it here. As you see, it has a two leather binding, and it is printed in Berlin 1907 and celebrates the famous Wartburg, its restoration. The Wartburg is the place to which Luther was removed in the fake kidnapping when he came back from the Diet at Worms, where he wrote his translation of the Bible. And it is under, as you see, sumptuously gotten up under the protectorate of a prince, and it has colored illustrations beside. It is a marvel of bookmaking and printing. The next item is one of the oldest and most important items in the collection. This is a pamphlet by Martin Luther from 1520. This is Ein Sermon von dem Bann. This is a sermon on the excommunication. Martin Luther was excommunicated in 1521, so it was written a year before that. Whether he already knew that he would be excommunicated, I'm not quite sure. I think he foresaw it. But this is an interesting connection. Here is an example of a family chronicle of the 16th century, 1573. And it is a handwritten book. A aristocratic family. I show it mostly as an example of the kind of historical sources which are available in the collection. This is a hand-colored title page of it. Of the next one is two pages from a work on mining, one of the first volumes on mining. I cannot show you the title or the cover because the first 94 pages are missing. But it is a very rare illustrated book has a gold mine on mining. This is another of the illustrations, just again a sample of the many, many cultural, historical plates in these books. Works of art in themselves very often. This is an interesting book. It's the translation of a French book on demonology, a book by Jean Bodin. The French original, appeared in 1593, and 1 year later, the translation had already been made and published here by a German, well-known German humanist of the 16th century, John Fishart, a very well-known writer and pamphleteer. The next one is a chronicle, a Saxon chronicle of 1585. You'll see the beautifully printed titles, which often go over whole pages. Again, a historical source of first magnitude. Now, I had shown you in the Wartburg book and you have seen in the Antiphonal large books. This is a miniature, though it doesn't show in the magnification here. It is a pigskin or parchment binding, and it is a French book. Almanach genealogique on the year 1714. And besides, it is besides calendars and other things, it has very useful instruction for the readers. This means connaissance pratique du monde, practical knowledge of the world, a course in how to live right. So they had some fun with their calendars too. Now, here is a Schlesisches Wappenbuch, a heraldry, a book on heraldry from 1846, probably. And it is, again, it shows a dedication to the King of Prussia, and it has beautiful illustrations, works of art in themselves again. Now we come to a religious book, a prayer book of 1813, but it has jeweled clasps, as you see, and it is meant to serve in the Protestant congregations of Schleswig and Holstein. Now we come to bindings here with gold pressing. This is a German edition of Homer's Odyssey with drawings and illustrations by a famous German graphic artist of the time, 19th century Preller, a standard work. Here you'll see a illustration on top and a full page illustration. This is Calypso. The edition is very well known, beloved particularly because of its illustrations. Now here is something Goethe, Goethe Galerie. This is illustrations to Goethe's works, and by Kaulbach, Wilhelm von Kaulbach. This is 19th century. There is a picture of from Werther seeing his beloved Lotte for the first time in the bosom of her family. And then there is, how did that, Unser Bismarck, history of the 19th century from about 1895, a sumptuous binding. And there is also his one special book on his funeral and death. There seems to be a particular spot in Mr. Ameling's heart for Bismarck, I guess. Here is a book on German art in picture and song. And that means more or less poems. The binding is, of course, again, gold worth. And here you see illustrations. And we come now to travel literature. Here is a Voyage en Suisse in French. Paris, no date, probably the end of middle or end of the 19th century. Gold decorated bindings, many illustrations, engraving, colored engravings of the costumes, national and regional costumes of Switzerland should be particularly interesting and dear to Mrs. Kenny. Here is a similar book on the Rhine, this time in English. Again, the binding is worth and similar to its content. 1872, illustrations are on the line with the cover, Worms, cathedrals. You have seen some of these downtown, downstairs. Another one, Palestina, Palestine, very topical, in built and word, in picture and text, 1884. Illustrations are always there, particularly important for travel books. And now we come to our own shores, a geographic description or geography of America. There is though an E missing in America on the, up there, but that doesn't lessen its value. Here is this is 1777, just 200 years ago, and you'll see a picture of an American chief, a sachem, who exhorts his people to war. And here is something now closer to home, California. Nature and life on the shores of the Pacific Ocean. From 1903, inside you'll find many photographs of agriculture, because it was an agricultural committee which went there to study California. But the cover is particularly important. It does not have the title. It says, Willkommen in California! Welcome to California. So such items abound. Here is something less Pacific. Die Erdbebenkatastrophe in San Francisco von einem Augenzeugen erlebt und erzählt. The earthquake catastrophe in San Francisco experienced or witnessed and told by an eyewitness, Dr. R. Wolf, no relation. He was a medical doctor at the Virchow Krankenhaus in Berlin, a very famous hospital. Now we come to the children's books. Here is one very appealing, Von Berg und Tal, from Mountain and Valley, by Ottilie Wildermuth, a famous, my wife gets nostalgic, famous author of children's stories. Everybody read her. Stuttgart, no year. Here is one of those irresistible illustrations. Here is a primer, first object lessons, and the object lessons are like this in German and French yet, Elizabeth. Ein Bleistift, un crayon. Ein Federmesser, un canif. We can learn French again with German. That reminds me of a famous ditty we used to learn. La vache, le bœuf der ox, la vache die cou, ferme la porte, die Tür macht zu. That is the way it went. Le bœuf der ox, la vache die cou. Now the last item is this historical binding, leather binding from 1663. It is called a commentaria in Ecclesiasticum, a commentary to the book of Ecclesiasticus. That is, it has this, by a lapide, it has this beautiful plate as an inside title, but only the first 20 pages are really this book. It is a fake book. The rest is a hollowed out box which contains some various items from Mr. Amelang. There is even a cigar on top there. And it, Dr. Kenny told me that it was not unknown that people carried their whiskey bottles in such concealed way. And I remember a movie with Miss Mitchum, where impersonated a preacher in a Western, and he carried his guns in a hollowed-out Bible. So that is the last curious item I would like you to get acquainted with. Now, is there any more? Okay. Now for the rest, we have now heard about the Amelon collection. You have seen some samples of the Amelon collection. But we haven't heard anything about the man who collected the collection, who is responsible for its existence, and ultimately, therefore, for us being able to buy it. So I think it is appropriate to spend a few more minutes on Mr. Amelon himself. Now, the information on Mr. Amelon comes mostly from a Mr. McDowell, his lawyer and executor of his estate. He is the father of Roddy McDowell, the movie actor. And most of it was communicated to Dr. Kenny. In preparation of this talk, we submitted a list of questions to Mr. McDowell over the telephone, and he was very gracious answering them all. But there was some difficulty because Mr. McDowell had a throat operation not long ago and can hardly speak above a whisper. So we had a hard time often getting what he said. But he, again, very graciously and cooperatively volunteered to answer further questions by letter. And so Dr. Kenny wrote him a letter with some additional questions that he wrote back quite soon with more information. Now, we know something about his personal background, about his antecedents, but partially from these information, and partially because we found a sumptuous family chronicle among the books of the collection. But it was a kind of form book, printed pages where you put, I was born this day, and this was my father, my grandfather, and this was these were my children, there I went to school. But all the pages were completely blank. There was no information. But in the front of the book, there were some items, a handwritten family tree of the Amelon family, and some other genealogical information, handwritten. It seems, at least that what I surmise, that Mr. Amelon intended to write a family history, a chronicle, and fill in this book, but he never got to it. So we know some of his background. He was born in Köthen, Germany, in 1890. He died in Los Angeles in 1973, 83 years old. He came to the United States shortly before World War I. He moved to Los Angeles around 1930 after having been in Arizona and other places. And he acquired or established a lumber company in La Cañada, a suburb of Los Angeles, Amelon Lumber Company. He lived, though, in a house in North Serrano in Los Angeles, and you saw some two photos of the house which Dr. Kenny took and had enlarged. He was married to a German widow from Chicago, but she died in 1960. There were no children. After his wife's death, Mr. Amelon became a complete recluse. He stayed practically all the time in his house and read the books he had collected. He hardly left home, only on occasional business trips or going to go to auctions to buy books. And Mr. McDowell had to drive him on these occasions. There were no visitors except his lawyer and his doctor. I don't know. I haven't found out yet who cooked for him. Do you know?
No.
The house was never cleaned. I was not in the house, but Dr. Kenny was and Dr. Zabot, and they can testify that it looked like it. There was practically no room to turn around anyway because books were everywhere, including the bathrooms, I've been told, and it was filthy and dirty. But he was not a complete recluse or hermit. He had particularly strong ties to Germany still. His social life, one fact we know, that he was a member of the Los Angeles German Lodge or society, the Schlaraffia. And he traveled once every year to Germany. Though he had no children himself, he had brothers and sisters living in Germany. And though we do not know for sure what he did in Germany on these trips, we must have visited some of his relatives. The last time he went was a year before his death, 1972. And now, Köthen in East Germany is between Halle and Leipzig. By the way, part of his family lived in West Germany, between Halle and Leipzig. And we have no information about his personality or character or educational background. We don't know why he collected books, when he started, what his education was. There's no indication of academic background. He must have gone through high school, that is German high school, which takes at least in the two first years of college, because the collection cannot have been done by an illiterate or badly educated person. It shows that he went at least through high school. It has the typical stress on humanistic classical areas, which I myself, for instance, went through. Now, Köthen is a small industrial town of about 50,000 inhabitants today. Historically, its main claim to fame is the fact that Johann Sebastian Bach spent 6 years there as a court composer of the Duke of Köthen-Anhalt. And during these 6 years, he wrote most of his secular works. Now, for us now, there is a second claim to notoriety and fame for Anhalt, for Köthen, that is the fact that it is the birthplace of Mr. Max Amelung. Maybe we should send a delegation to Köthen and affix a plaque to his house, the house where he was born, if it still stands, and express our gratitude for what he did for our library. In the meantime, before we can do that, let us enjoy the fruits of Mr. Amelung's collection and put them to good use. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Wolf. That was just wonderful. Even those of us who've worked on the board and felt very closely connected to the Amelung collection had never seen that much of it. There is one person here tonight, though, who may have seen as much of the collection as Dr. Wolf, and I would like to have you meet her. She's a member of our advisory committee, and she and one of our other board members unpacked most of the Amelung's 11,000 books.
And they survived.
They not only survived, they thought it was fun. Mrs. Amy Jo Wormser, she collected your donations downstairs, and Amy Jo, would you have a minute afterward? Are there any books left down there? There are just a few, and Amy Jo said she'd stay for just a few minutes if you want to look at them again. And as our evening comes to a close,
I put them in the box and slid them into the office down there. But anyone is interested, we'd be glad to bring them out.
Oh, all right. Ich wünsche Ihnen alles ein fröhliches Weihnachtsfest und ein glückliches neues Jahr. Auf Wiedersehen.